right, we're going to get started with our next panel. I want to remind our online audience that we will be taking questions both online and in person. For our online audience, you can join the conversation and submit questions directly on the event webpage, on Facebook, YouTube, and on X using hashtag Cato1A as in First Amendment. My name's Tommy Berry. I'm a research fellow here in Cato's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of our Cato Supreme Court Review. And I'm thrilled to have a fantastic panel here to discuss the NetChoice case and specifically how the oral arguments went just 2 days ago. So starting directly to my left, we have Corbin Barthold. He is Tech Freedom's Internet Policy Counsel and Director of Appellate Litigation. Corbin clerked for the Honorable Stephen D. Meriday of the Middle District of Florida and the Honorable Robert H. Cleland of the Eastern District of Michigan. He was then an associate and partner in the Los Angeles office of Brown George Ross LLP, where he engaged in high-stakes complex litigation. He then served as senior litigation counsel at Washington Legal Foundation, a D.C. public interest firm, focusing on appeals in administrative law, separation of powers, antitrust, and tech policy. He received his J.D. from UC Berkeley School of Law and holds a B.A. magna cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from UC San Diego and an M.S.C. with distinction from the London School of Economics. To his left, Ash Bhagwat joined the UC Davis School of Law faculty in 2011. Prior to joining UC Davis, he taught at UC Hastings College of the Law for 17 years. Bhagwat is the author of The Myth of Rights, published by Oxford University Press in 2010, and Our Democratic First Amendment, published by Cambridge in 2020. He's a summa cum laude graduate of Yale University, where he received a BA with honors in history, and a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, where he served as articles editor of the University of Chicago Law Review. He completed clerkships with Judge Richard A. Posner of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and Associate Justice Anthony M. Kennedy of the U.S. Supreme Court. Prior to joining the Hastings faculty, Bhagwat practiced appellate and regulatory law for 2 years in the D.C. office of Sidley and Austin. And then to his left, James Z is an associate at Clement and Murphy, which, as many of you probably know, was very involved in the case we'll be discussing today. Indeed, he had the best seat in the House for oral argument. Jimmy clerked for Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh of the U.S. Supreme Court and Judge Jeffrey S. Sutton of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. He also served as an appellate attorney for the Civil Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, where he briefed and argued cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and prepared draft briefs for the Solicitor General for filing in the U.S. Supreme Court. Jimmy graduated from Stanford Law School, where he was a Kirkland and Ellis Scholar and a member of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic. So even though you're farthest from me, Jimmy, I'll start with you. Just for our audience, not everyone here we expect to be a lawyer or even necessarily to be following these cases super closely, can you just sort of give the basics of what was this case about? What was the dispute? What's the question presented, and why does it matter?
Sure. So at bottom, like, this case is about whether the government can override decisions by, you know, platforms like Facebook and Google and YouTube about, like, what content to leave up and what to take down. And so, you know, Florida and Texas passed laws, I think 3 years ago now, that basically overrode those judgments and said, you know, we think you're moderating your content inconsistently and you're taking down more conservative content than liberal content. And so we're going to impose all these requirements on you. And, you know, so Florida law, for example, it says you're not allowed to take down content about political candidates, anything posted by journalistic enterprises. You have to apply your standards consistently. And the Texas law, similarly, it says you're not allowed to engage in viewpoint discrimination when you decide what to take down and what to keep up. So, and the question presented in the court was whether that is consistent with the First Amendment.
Great. And Corbin, I'm wondering, can you give a little background on kind of how did we get to this moment? Why is this now coming up to the court? Why are we now seeing laws passed like this? What sort of led, do you think, Florida and Texas to think that this was necessary?
Well, to answer that question, we have to get into a time machine and go back to this long-lost world before Elon Musk purchased Twitter and turned it into X. Early 2021, there was a lot of rancor, particularly on the political right, about the content moderation decisions of Twitter in particular. We all remember the Hunter Biden laptop New York Post story. That was kind of the bloody red shirt that got waved around when that story was temporarily blocked and suppressed on Twitter and Facebook. So you had this campaign, starting with Florida passed SB 7072 first, and then Texas did HB 20, to get the big tech oligarchs of Silicon Valley to stop silencing conservative speech. I'm pretty strictly paraphrasing things that were actually said by these politicians, and we might get into what is the impact of those statements on this case, because they then put those laws together in ways that kind of took that goal maybe a little out of the actual text, or maybe not, we can discuss. But that was the impetus, was to level the speech playing field, to level the speech marketplace on these platforms. Another topic we may get into is how much more broadly these laws sweep. They do much more than intended, if that's the goal of the laws. But that's what spurred us on. We then, net choice, as we heard earlier, went into the district court very quickly. Both the district courts in Florida and Texas enjoined these laws. The 11th Circuit, at least with the key provisions we'll probably focus on today, affirmed. The 5th Circuit issued a ruling without opinion letting HB 20 go into effect. Everybody scrambled up to the Supreme Court to get emergency relief. The court granted that, so HB 20 was reblocked. Then we had cert petitions. We had a call for the views of the Solicitor General from the court, which was a way to punt this case from the previous term to this one. They had Gonzalez versus Google already, the Section 230 case, and I think they'd had enough internet law for 1 year. So that delayed things for a year, and then we briefed it, oral argument, here we are.
Great. And Ash, you've done a lot of scholarship on First Amendment, how it interacts with regulations of the internet. Do you see any precedents or anything you can compare these to, either in the history of the internet or even in the old dead tree media? Or do you think these are kind of raising a completely novel question?
Both.
Yeah.
The reality is that the big issue here is what we analogize social media platforms to. The NetChoice wants to, I think correctly, analogize them to newspapers, and we certainly have precedent going back to the 70s saying newspapers get to decide what to publish. Mm-hmm. And if that analogy holds, then clearly Texas and Florida's laws are unconstitutional, which is my opinion. They want to analogize platforms more to something like a telephone company, what we call a common carrier. I mean, these are entities going back to inns in medieval England that were assumed to have an obligation to serve everyone without discrimination. And if they were common carriers, then, in fact, requiring them not to discriminate regarding content would be constitutional. Certainly, telephone companies don't choose who their customers are. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely analogies. The difficulty is, of course, when you have a wholly new technology, all analogies are imperfect. Mm-hmm. We're picking between imperfect analogies. I think that the newspaper analogy is the better one because social media companies do not transparently deliver content in the way that telephone companies do. When I pick the phone, what I say goes to the person I'm calling without any interference by AT&T. And if that was true of social media, we wouldn't be here. Right? In some ways, I think the arguments that Florida and Texas are making are internally contradictory. They're saying we're going to treat you as common carriers because you're not acting as common carriers, because you're not transparently moving information. And to my mind, that's not right. You can't take away people's First Amendment rights by fiat, which is essentially what I think they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And that really segues into what I was going to ask Jimmy next, which is, okay, we're going up to the Supreme Court. You're on the litigation team, writing the brief that's going to go to the Supreme Court. Justice Elena Kagan has admitted they're not necessarily the 9 greatest experts on the internet. In every case, they come to it as generalists. So I'm just curious, whatever you're comfortable saying, what do you think about when you're writing a brief on these novel questions for the Supreme Court? What sort of big ideas do you want them to come away from, and how do you think about what to focus on and how to make it sort of easily comprehensible to justices of various backgrounds?
Yeah, so I certainly think it helps that, they had internet cases last term, right? So they had Section 230, they had TOMNA. And so, they're already grappling with some of these issues. And obviously, Justice Thomas has written about Section 230 and how it applies to websites like Facebook, et cetera, a while ago. But, I think what was helpful was to focus on, general broad principles, right? And the through line in all this Supreme Court cases and the First Amendment is, you know, you can't, like, you can't try to, the government can't try to, you know, bolster the voices of some by, you know, suppressing, you know, the speech of others. And, like, at bottom, that's I think, what's going on here, right? It's, you know, they're trying to tell, you know, social media platforms you have to carry speech in order to bolster speech that might not otherwise be as prominently disseminated. And so, you know, focusing on those broad themes and analogizing to newspapers and things of that nature, I think, was pretty helpful.
And that principle of you can't suppress some to boost others, that goes back to the pre-internet age, the Buckley versus Valeo, exactly. The famous campaign finance case, which, you know, the justices might be more comfortable living in that realm. Corbin, Tech Freedom filed an amicus brief supporting NetChoice. Can you tell us sort of what was the argument you pressed there, and what was your thinking about how to supplement and complement the arguments NetChoice was making in their brief?
Sure, yes. So although the oral argument was a mixed bag in some ways, it was a very good day for Tech Freedom because our brief focused on the common carrier theory. And if you eliminate what lawyers were saying at the judge and just look at what the justices were saying, I think there was no appetite for the common carrier theory on the bench. Even Justice Thomas, who this has been sort of his hobby horse to suggest that this regime might apply to social media platforms, he didn't really raise it. Our brief got into the fundamental sort of non sequitur of taking this area of common law that, as Osh mentioned, goes back centuries to the novel many-to-many communication of social media. Social media is inherently an edited product. It is inherently a public product where people are all talking and we can all see what's being said. And those really take it out of this common carrier paradigm, and that was our focus. Common carriage law, if you dig back and look, you know, it grew out of carrying stuff. You know, the classic example, of course, is a railroad, you know, shipping box of pears, you know, across state lines somewhere, and the rules say, you know, you can't discriminate among your customers when you're just carrying these commodity products. That's not what speech is here. Well, I should add, you know, it was extended modestly to telegrams and the telephone. You're still talking about private communication. So you basically have what you might think of as sort of widgets of private information being shipped along the dumb pipes. And so it is still somewhat analogous to that original example. What you had in the Fifth Circuit was one judge, Judge Andy Oldham, not speaking for the court, really extending this out. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people in the audience have read A Matter of Interpretation, you know, Antonin Scalia's book. And he notes that in our modern democracy, common law judging, there's a really uncomfortable relationship between unelected judges expanding common law concepts when we are in a democracy and we pass laws by statute and we have the Constitution. So what you really had was a judge stretching this common law concept to constrict the First Amendment. And I think it came out at argument. The justices kind of recognized that this doesn't make any sense. At one point, one of the attorneys raised common carrier law to Justice Barrett, and she immediately said, well, just put that aside and then answer my question without that there. It wasn't framed very coherently by counsel, to be perfectly honest. I thought the Solicitor General of Texas wasn't winning anyone over by saying the common carrier rules are a compass. You know, a compass to what? And so, you know, to end on a slightly sour note, that doesn't win you the case. I've heard people going around saying, well, if they're not common carriers, Texas loses. We know that's not the case. The Fifth Circuit ruled without common carrier. Oldham was alone. It was Judge Jones and Judge Oldham together basically ruling the wrong way in the battle of analogies that Osh was mentioning earlier. But it's a good sign that the justices recognize that this is just sort of an unnecessary epicycle that we can just put to one side and not think about further.
Yeah. Osh, you've written a lot of scholarship on these issues. You know, we don't want every stage here to just be an echo chamber. I'm curious, is there anything, are there any arguments made by either NetChoice or supporters of NetChoice where you maybe wouldn't go quite as far as them? Or do you think there could be some closer questions, if not in this case, in perhaps related future cases?
Yeah. So I think NetChoice seemed to be going as far as to say that essentially all functions of these companies, including, say, Gmail, are immune from common carrier classification and or DM systems, and therefore any sort of editorial control that they want to exercise, they can. I don't agree. And I would add the United States, the Solicitor General, did not agree with that position. I think that Gmail is different because it is transparent, by and large. I think direct messaging is different. It's private, it's transparent. It fits much more the common carrier model. But I think that's not what Texas cares about. After all, Gmail is not kicking people off its system, right? I mean, that's not a thing. And so kind of there was a lot of hiding the ball and moving around stuff. The big question here is social media platforms as we traditionally understand them. That is all that Texas and Florida was really focused on. Mm-hmm. And I think there, I do agree with NetChoice. I think they're right. But for example, Justice Kavanaugh has taken the position that even ISPs, like your internet service provider, cannot be regulated as a common carrier. There was a very funny back and forth during oral argument about that. I disagree with Justice Kavanaugh on that. I think it can be. I mean, I think it's possible for you to take one to take middle positions and still think Texas and Florida made a mistake here.
Yeah.
Really quick, Tommy. Yeah. HB 20 has an email provision. We all forgot about it because nobody challenged it. And it's just
which state that is?
Sitting around. That's Texas.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to flag. Nobody brought that up at argument.
Yeah.
So I don't. Huh. We'll see what happens with that.
So we have the briefing is submitted in the case, and then Jimmy, obviously you work at Clement and Murphy. You were on the core litigation team helping to prepare Paul Clement to present oral argument. What goes into the preparing for an oral argument, and how is it distinct from briefing? What's distinct in the way you present arguments? Do you think about responding to arguments in the brief that you didn't get a chance to on paper? And what is that process like as part of a team where one person argues it, but the whole team has to help that person be as prepared as possible?
So a lot goes into it. We hold moot courts. I think we held four in this case, which is a lot. It's usually nice to get people who are fresh to the case ask questions, as the justices might ask. And, just that iterative process, I think, is, helpful in sort of refining your answers and getting to the core themes that you want to highlight at argument. And so it's a lot of fun. But.
Yeah. And what do you think is the key difference between maybe how you would present an argument in a brief versus in person and, orally?
I think at oral argument, a lot of the stuff that gets discussed in the brief just doesn't come up, mm-hmm. and it sort of gets distilled into, I think, what are sort of the key sticking points that, some people might hang on when they question your position or the other side's position. And so, it's a really, really an opportunity to sort of address, all the, the key just nuances that, might not always get explored in briefing.
Yeah. So we have had oral argument 2 days ago. I was there in the courtroom. It was quite a marathon, as some people have said, for almost a full 4 hours. I guess we'll just start with Corbin. What surprised you the most? We had so much, writings about this, scholarship, amicus briefs, and yet you still can't always predict what the judges or justices are going to say.
Yeah, so you get all the merits briefing, you get all the amicus briefs. I don't think I answered your question of what are you looking to do as an amicus, and one thing that's very helpful is you can take an issue that maybe the merits counsel only has time to do a little bit and really expand on it. So, we expand on common carrier law. And then you get to oral argument, and things just fly in from left field. You never know what you're going to get suddenly. It's, well, what about Uber? Last term in Gonzalez versus Google, we were talking about thumbnails for some reason. You just never know what's going to come in. Sir, this is a Wendy's. Mm-hmm. Who saw that coming into the argument? So the surprises to me were very much the issues that the justices fixated on that I see as very extraneous to the merits of this case. We did all that briefing in Gonzalez versus Google on Section 230. They punted, and now Justice Gorsuch is super interested in doing a revolutionary Section 230 opinion. Mm-hmm. The facial challenge, that's in Texas's brief. They kind of focused on it more. Florida didn't talk about it much. And suddenly the whole issue is, well, is the facial challenge appropriate for Florida's law? And that becomes a huge thing, which I can dive into separately if you want. The notion that we should be diving into those things instead of just looking at what the 11th Circuit cleanly ruled, that was surprising to me.
Yeah, definitely. Ash, what were your takeaway? What surprised you?
The focus on procedure and facial challenges surprised me. It felt a little bit like it was coming out of left field. I agree. That's not the way the cases were litigated. And it's, I think, the whole body of law that the court justices were talking about is so deeply confused that it didn't really advance the ball. But what surprised me a little bit was that the justices were having a hard time really focusing in on what the real issue here is, which is user-generated content. I mean, they were talking about, you know, whether or not Uber would be able to discriminate in picking who their customers were. That's not the issue here. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're talking about, for example, requiring Uber to be content viewpoint neutral, as Texas might if it covered Uber, the question is whether someone's allowed to leave a racist comment about a driver. That's what Uber doesn't want, and the question is, should they be forced to permit racist comments? And that distinction between discriminating against people, which nobody supports, and discriminating against racist content, which I think most social media companies don't want hate speech on their sites, even though it is constitutionally protected, the justices were confusing that in ways that I found surprising and a little distressing, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy, I won't presume anything surprised you after four moots. I know nothing has ever surprised Paul Clement at the Supreme Court, or if it has, he wouldn't know because he's always so smooth. So just what was your reaction to oral argument, either as it was happening or now with a couple days' distance?
Yeah. Well, we certainly expected some questions about facial as versus as applied, but you know, as Corbin pointed out, the extent of it was a little surprising to me. But you know, I thought it was quite telling that the justices that seemed to be the most hostile, they were focused on procedure and not about the actual merits. And it seemed like most of them at least agreed that at least for the core, you know, social media websites like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, X, et cetera, you can't tell them what to take down and what to keep up. It's their sort of decision, and that's protected by the First Amendment, which is, I think, why, the ones that were hostile to us focused mostly on procedure rather than anything else. I guess one thing that was slightly surprising was, you know, a lot of the arguments that got raised in the briefs by Texas and Florida about why we weren't newspapers and, you know, the Parade and Hurley and the newsletter and PG&E, you know, they made points about misattribution, concerns about misattribution and space constraints. None of that really got aired that much, and when it did get aired, there wasn't a whole ton of pushback. So we feel pretty confident that at least for the core social media websites, I think we have it went pretty well for us there.
So let's dive in a little deeper, Corbin. You offered it. So this debate about facial versus as applied challenge, can you kind of spell out, you know, in a way that maybe a non-lawyer could at least somewhat grasp, what is the difference between these two? Why were the justices so fixated on it?
Yes, so I will try not to get too deep into the weeds. I apologize for those of you who aren't lawyers, but this is a big thing that was at the argument, so we have to deal with it. Going to before the lawsuit was filed, James and company had to make a decision of whether to make an as-applied challenge or a facial challenge to this law. Strategically, I think they clearly made the correct decision. If you bring an as-applied challenge, you open yourself up to a lot of difficulty with a motion to dismiss and potentially getting into discovery, because the immediate answer to any as-applied challenge is, well, let's poke and prod at you and figure out exactly how your product works and get into the weeds on very difficult questions, and that bogs everything down. So you want to bring a facial challenge, especially in the context of the First Amendment. And the 11th Circuit understood that that made a lot of sense and that that was correct. And then we kind of got lost in a cul-de-sac at the Supreme Court oral argument. And I'll say at the outset, my hunch is they will go back and they will sort of reread the Supreme Court precedent and they will get themselves righted again, and this is not going to derail the appeal. I've now thrown a hostage to fortune, right? there was a lot of talk about what's called the Salerno standard. If the law is about boxes of pears and consumer protection, facial challenges are very, very hard. Under Salerno, you need to show that the law is unconstitutional in every last application. That's not fun. The First Amendment facial challenge stuff has been evolving a bit. Overbreadth used to be this thing where it kind of looked like it's just for if the law applies to me and I admit it's valid to me, but I want to protect other people to avoid chilling speech, so I argue that it's overbroad. We certainly heard Justice Alito in his solo dissent in a decision called Stevens harping on that. The court seems to have drifted away from that. Now, in a decision called Bonta, you have the rule that if there are a substantial number of unconstitutional applications in relation to the law's legitimate sweep, that's enough to get you a successful facial challenge under the First Amendment. But then we run into the complication that this is a very broad and some might say sloppy law in Florida. So then does that run you back to Stevens, where they said, look, if we don't understand the sweep of the law, how do we figure out what the legitimate scope is? And if it's a state law, do we have to go to the state Supreme Court to get them to interpret the law? So that's a pitfall. Really, this stuff will start getting you very turned around. But what I think is key here, again, it's a First Amendment case. Clement brought up a case called Minneapolis Star, and I do think there's sort of a special solicitude to facial challenges that try to suppress speech, and particularly in this case, that aim at speakers. NetChoice tried to bring an issue of speaker discrimination before the court, and the court didn't express much interest in deciding that issue, and it can open up cans of worms. But in Minneapolis Star, we had a law that said, we're going to apply a use tax on ink and paper on a select set of big newspapers, and they weren't happy with that. The Supreme Court, they struck it down as a speaker-based discrimination. They relied on a decision called Grosjean, which was a similar tax on newspapers where the governor had said, I'm going to go after the lying newspapers. It's very clear what's happening here. If you look at SB 7072, it still does say in the law, notwithstanding that the politicians didn't put sort of their worst animus in there, it says, these platforms have been acting in bad faith, and that's why we're going to regulate them. I don't know how coherent much of what I said is to somebody who's not steeped in this stuff, but the long story short is, I don't think they're going to have a problem saying, in this instance, with this sloppy law that we're not sure what's going on, we're happy to uphold this preliminary injunction because you've gone after speech and you've done it in this sort of blunderbuss fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Asha, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think actually it's fairly straightforward if they want to do it. I mean, honestly, this facial versus as applied stuff, the court doesn't use these rules in any level of consistency. It often manipulates them to choose what issues to reach, what not to reach. I agree. I think it was telling that Justices Thomas and Alito were so focused on procedure because I think they realized they lost on the merits. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard to write an opinion that says, with respect to the core content moderation policies of the core social media platforms, what you're really worried about, which is X, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, First Amendment does not permit you to interfere with their content moderation because they have a First Amendment right, I think under the press clause, not the speech clause, strange that never came up, mm-hmm. To choose what content to have. And as for the rest, I'm going to remand to you lower courts, and you guys figure out if this law reaches Gmail. And if it does, you guys figure out if Gmail actually has First Amendment rights. None of this has been litigated yet. Case isn't over. This is just a preliminary injunction. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of time to work out the details. But on the core issues where we need to have clear rules, because lack of clarity is a problem with free speech. It causes what's called chilling effects, which is people get worried about doing things that are going to get them into trouble. Florida, in particular, has authorized massive fines mm-hmm. That anyone can sue to get. I think it behooves the court to provide clarity on those core issues because they're important.
Yeah, and that's a great point on the chilling effect and the potential fines. Jimmy, do you want to talk a bit about sort of the immediate stakes of this case? The court is weighing, keep this injunction in place. I mean, what would potentially happen if they said, let's relitigate it at some point, and while you're doing that, let's let the whole law be in place. I mean, that would kind of be uncharted territory, right?
Yeah, and I think like it would pose incredible challenges to my clients' businesses, and they would, I think, like, you know, you heard that argument, Texas included a provision in its law that said you can't discriminate against Texans, mm-hmm. and that was there essentially to prevent, like, you know, Facebook or YouTube from saying we're going to withdraw from the state if this law goes into effect. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like, it'd be extremely challenging to apply, and you know, like, I don't know if it's feasible.
Mm-hmm. So. I'm going to start doing toss-ups because I don't want us to just be down the line. So anyone feel free to weigh in on some topics that I found interesting that were often discussed. There was a lot of discussion about what is the speech, what is the message of a social media site? If they block everybody except one person, what if people don't know that like a person has been blocked from a social media site? Does that mean that they're not sending a coherent message? So what are your all thoughts on, are we talking about the speech of the social media platforms, or are we really talking about their editorial freedom, and are those maybe two different or distinct things?
So I want to answer that because that's kind of what I was hinting at earlier, yeah. is I think they're completely different things. Just as Thomas kept asking, what's the message? But that's, again, this is the Supreme Court has, for a textualist court, it's very weird that they don't read the text of the First Amendment, but they don't. The Supreme Court has forgotten that the First Amendment does not just protect speech, it also protects press freedoms and other freedoms as well. I think the argument for a distinct editorial right, not that you're sending a message, it's just that you don't want to, if you were Ben Franklin, you don't want to print a particular pamphlet that you really find offensive. If you're a printer in the 18th century, that is a distinct right. It is not about expressing yourself. It is about essentially choosing not to spread the expression of others. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to have a message, right? It doesn't have to be a coherent message. It's simply, I am Facebook, and from the beginning, I have not wanted hate speech or nudity on my platform because I have a particular user experience I want to create. I think that is independently protected by the First Amendment, and that's one of the great confusions that occurred to me during oral argument, and it shows up in the Fifth Circuit opinion as well, is an inability to distinguish between that editorial issue and that expressive issue, though I think your justice got it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was a difficulty if you're counsel for Florida, Texas, what I would call the Miami Herald Hurley pincer movement. So Miami Herald versus Tornillo involved newspapers and, you know, holds you as the newspaper don't have to publish a right of reply because you have editorial control over your product. And counsel for the states want to say, well, no, you know, the platforms aren't nearly that picky. They let a lot of stuff through. They're only moderating a small percentage of the content, and that just runs them right into the Hurley buzzsaw, because in Hurley we had a parade. It was a Boston St. Patrick's Day parade, and in the record it was clear they didn't block people. It's actually a slightly sordid case in the sense that the gay rights group that they blocked from marching in the parade was like the only group, it seemed, that had been blocked, which really suggests a sort of discriminatory animus. And say what you will about those bad facts, it led to a very strong holding because the court said, look, a speech product, an expressive product, is not itself a public accommodation. And we're just not gonna go there, which I think is smart because you get these extreme hypotheticals about, you know, well, what if you block this sweeping sort of speech or whatever, and then you swing right back around to Miami Herald, because the New York Times tomorrow could wake up and say, we're a GOP broadsheet now. We're switching our policy. We're blocking all speech that's liberal. And then the next day it could go back and say, no, we're back to what we were before. That's your editorial right. So once you've established that the product is about these editorial choices, it doesn't matter whether it's this really coherent message or whether it's just sort of you can come in and speak, but you know, we reserve the right to block this and that and the other.
Jimmy, any thoughts on the?
Yeah, Hurley actually mentioned it, said, like, you know, the parade didn't have a particularized message, and the decision to exclude, you know, the gay lesbian group, like, the reason wasn't entirely clear, and even the group itself didn't have a particularly clear message that it wanted to send by participating in the parade. And the court said, like, none of that mattered, right? It's the whole idea is like you can't be compelled to carry speech or disseminate speech that you don't want to carry. That principle applies regardless of whether, you know, your parade has a particularized message.
So. Yeah. So Texas and Florida, they relied on a couple cases. Really heavily, they relied on the Pruneyard case. That was the focus of our amicus brief here at Cato. You know, us libertarian maximalists, I think Pruneyard was wrongly decided. But even that's overruling it is not on the table here. The question is it distinguishable? That was a case essentially where the Supreme Court said it's permissible for California to force privately owned open air shopping malls to have a kind of be free speech zones to allow pamphleteers and picketers. What were thoughts on how the justices reacted to that argument? Texas and Florida want to say this is like Pruneyard. This is private property, but we just want it to be a free speech zone.
I think the justices were correctly dismissive of that argument. Shopping centers are not media. Mm-hmm. Their role is not to disseminate speech. People who run shopping centers do so that people can shop. It's entirely the analogy between that and a social media platform whose whole job is to disseminate speech strikes me as being honestly nuts. And the Rumsfeld case, the other one they relied on, was written by Chief Justice Roberts, who literally said during oral argument, I don't think Rumsfeld controls, so I think we're good on that too.
Yeah, that was very nice.
any thoughts on?
Yeah, when you... I snarkily say sometimes, conservatives for Pruneyard, you know, when I see these sort of people in the red states who wave that decision around, I know that we live in weird times. Because I remember being in law school back in sort of the before four and thinking Pruneyard was this like awful decision and all of my liberal Berkeley law students were super stoked on it. You know, they were really glad about this sort of everybody gets an equal soapbox idea, you know, that line in Buckley versus Vallejo that you alluded to earlier that Kavanaugh brought up, they hated that. And weirdly, things have now flipped. But the reality is that the analogies are just very, very poor. We saw Sotomayor bring that up. She said, look, you're not letting people, like, go in the stores at the Pruneyard Shopping Center. Sotomayor also brought up... quick diversion of the common carrier thing, but, you know, common carriers didn't have to put up with, like, obnoxious speech. You could kick somebody off the train if they were yelling at patrons some of the stuff you see on social media. That would have been totally fine. So to get Pruneyard or Rumsfeld to look like this case, like, to pick up on Rumsfeld, which is about job recruiters, military job recruiters had to be allowed on law school campuses under a law passed by Congress. I won't get into the details. But long story short, to make that case look right here, you would need to be saying, no, you can let like neo-Nazis come into the lecture halls. Like you'd have to make this talk right now an open forum where anybody can come up and start shouting whatever they want and they have a legal right to do it. That's what it would take to make Rumsfeld look like this case.
Yeah, for sure. Pretty soon we're going to move on to this. I want to hone in on predictions and thoughts about individual justices. But first, any topics I haven't raised yet that you all thought were particularly struck you or that you think people should focus on if they read the transcript?
I think what struck me as being a little surprising was, Clement eventually got to it, but we have to understand, especially with the Texas statute, literally, if a platform cannot discriminate based on viewpoint, if they allow sort of suicide safety posts on, they have to allow posts that encourage suicide on their platform. Mm-hmm. That's nuts, right? That's crazy. And that's actually what, I mean, if they're going to allow anti-terrorism speech on, they have to allow terrorist propaganda on, so long as it doesn't cross the legal line, which is very far. Again, does that make any sense? I was surprised at how little conversation there was about those fairly extreme scenarios that are actually what we're talking about.
Yeah, Kagan got Texas's Solicitor General to basically admit that at one point.
Yeah,
Al-Qaeda, anti-Al-Qaeda.
I was surprised half of the 4 hours, that was 5 minutes, right? Yeah. It should have been at least an hour because that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, it came up. Under the Texas law, pro-terrorist speech, how does that get categorized under this viewpoint-neutral law? And Texas's Solicitor General said, well, it depends on how you categorize it. It's like, well, that's the question in every single content moderation decision. That means your law, like, is incoherent. Like, viewpoint neutrality, Texas doesn't actually know what that means in application any more than Florida has any idea what consistency, that's a requirement in the Florida law. They don't actually know what that means.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, in the Florida case, like, you know, we raised the example in our opening brief that the consistency provision would apparently require us to post, you know, pro-Al-Qaeda speech if we, like, take down, like, anti, or, yeah, if we take down, if we post pro, anti-Al-Qaeda speech, you have to also post pro-Al-Qaeda speech. Yep. And then in their response to Florida was like, no, that's actually not what the consistency provision means. You can have anti, like, you know, terrorism policy, but, like, that just means if you take down, like, pro-Al-Qaeda speech, you can't take down, like, pro-ISIS speech. So it's just like, I think, yeah, you're right. Like, they don't really know exactly, right? They don't know exactly what the consistency provision requires. And, you know, if you think about it, like, what does consistent manner mean? It's not entirely clear. We had a vagueness argument below. It wasn't at the core, but, you know, that's another way to go at it.
And that's another thing I would mention is that a lot of the conversation, we're treating the Texas and Florida laws as sort of the same. They're not. The Texas law is very clear. I just think it's just unconstitutional. I, to this day, don't fully understand what Florida was trying to do. Mm-hmm. Like the special preference for politicians, what's that about, right? Why do politicians have greater free speech rights than the rest of us? The special preference for journalistic enterprises, in this world, what is a journalistic enterprise? I mean, they have a definition, but it strikes me as being
extremely
very broad. In the modern world, when kind of the concept of journalism has become so amorphous. So mush. I think the Florida law is mush. The Texas law is unconstitutional, quite clearly.
Yeah, that's a great
Judge point. Newsom in 11th Circuit pointed out that, like, Pornhub would qualify as a journalistic enterprise.
Yeah, you just have to be popular, right? Or make a lot of content.
Yeah. And so under the Florida's law, YouTube Kids would have to carry Pornhub content, which is just, like, you know, that's insane.
That's a great point. So. You know, Jimmy, you had a front row seat. You're listening to it live. Any moments that stuck out, favorite moments where you're like, yes, I'm so glad that went perfectly for us, or just things that were particularly memorable for you?
So I loved when my old boss quoted, you know, Buckley versus Vallejo, yeah. Right? Said, you know, the most famous line in First Amendment history is you can't, you know, suppress the speech of some in order to enhance the relative voice of others. You know, I loved when he just read from Tornillo, because a lot of these same arguments were aired there, right? Like, you know, the idea that the Miami Herald had a monopoly in the local market, and, you know, they were biased and stuff like that. Like, those are all reasons given for why, you know, Florida needed this right of reply statute that would have given politicians a right to respond to critical commentary in the Miami Herald about them. And it's like the same arguments that are being raised here, right? It's like, you know, Facebook and YouTube are biased. They're a monopoly. They control, you know, vast amounts of speech that's being disseminated, and that's the reason why we need to tell them to carry speech they don't want to carry. It's the same exact arguments that's being aired 50 years later.
Yeah. It's often said that sometimes the justices are really talking to each other more than to the to the advocates, and that was a clear case. I was sitting in the audience, and when Justice Alito said he thought it was Orwellian to call censorship content moderation, I saw Justice Kavanaugh got a big smile on his face. He started chatting with Justice Kagan, and I think he started planning out what he was going to say and basically have this long rebuttal to Alito saying Orwellian is about government power. It's not
that was a great peroration. He said, I think of Orwellian, I think of government power, not private power. Orwellian is when a country takes over the media, like has happened in other countries. Like, let's put aside our like first world problems. I got my tweet, you know, blocked, and think about North Korea for a second. North Korea is Orwellian. And he said the First Amendment is a decision by us that we are not going to be that country. It is a decision we made, and that's been our policy since the beginning. So I recommend going back and actually reading what he said in the transcript.
Yeah. So, you know, tea leaf reading is always difficult. Any surprises about what was said by a particular justice where you thought they might be more or less sympathetic to net choice?
I will just dive in and say I've been trying to game this out. once again, Justice Jackson was a bit surprising, although not nearly as much so, because after she took the sort of MAGA-adjacent line with Section 230 in Gonzalez versus Google, now we know to expect that she might be a wild card. She seemed really in play. But beyond that, not too many surprises. I think you knew where Justice Kavanaugh was coming because he's already said his opinions and they match ruling for net choice. And there were no surprises there. If anything, the surprise was just how strongly he articulated his views at oral argument, which I thought was fantastic. Roberts, as we know from him rejecting Rumsfeld versus Fair being applied here, you know, he tends to keep his cards close at argument, but I don't see him ruling against net choice here. Justice Barrett, I think at one point basically said, well, this case is more analogous to Miami Herald versus Tornillo. She's been a pretty cautious minimalist since she's been on the court, and the cautious minimalist approach here is not to blow up the internet. Suffice it to say that Andy Oldham in the Fifth Circuit did not take the cautious minimalist approach. And then Sotomayor and Kagan, I think, were very alive to how broad these laws are, how insane they are in the ways that Osh was pointing out. There's 5 votes. So I still expect net choice to get a favorable ruling here. I don't think there was any reason to expect that Thomas or Alito will do anything different from the signals they've already given us. If anything, Alito signaled that he doesn't understand how content moderation really works. He doesn't understand that content moderation is X doing a better job than it's currently doing of having like boobs in bio not appear at the bottom of every tweet I do. And so, you know, maybe it's 5-4. Maybe Jackson joins the majority at 6-3, but you wanted tea leaf reading. Yeah, there's my, man, I'm throwing hostages to fortune left and right here, but that's how I read it.
That's awesome.
I agree. Jackson was really surprised me.
Yeah.
Her focus on the procedural issues, the as applied versus facial, it's sort of not really the big question in this case. It was a little surprising, but I think the choice has 5 votes. The interesting question for me is, how broad or narrow an opinion comes out. And I think it could easily be a fairly narrow opinion that just focuses on content moderation by what are clearly social media platforms and leaves the Ubers and the Etsys of the world for another day. And I think that I could see Barrett sort of insisting on that because of her minimalism. And I think that's not a bad result, honestly.
Yeah. Jimmy, anything you're willing to say?
I hope it's 9-0.
I love the optimism.
Good.
All right.
Unfortunately, if it's 9-0, that probably means it's some kind of punt.
Sad but true. All right, I want to remind our online audience, we're going to be moving to audience questions now. The online audience can join the conversation, submit questions directly on the event webpage, that's on our Cato page, on Facebook comments, on YouTube comments, or on X using hashtag Cato1A, C-A-T-O, numeral 1, letter A. We've got a couple of, I'll start with an online question here, and then we'll try to alternate back and forth online and in person. So we have one that says, if Texas and Florida win, then would SNSs, maybe it means social media sites, I'm not sure, or others, execute a domain block to shut down access to their servers' data centers? I'm not sure about geofencing. So this is, take that question however you like. There were questions about would, you know, Facebook just block every user in Texas and Florida? Could they do that? Would that violate the law? Any thoughts on if that's feasible or legal?
So I'm actually going to ask Jimmy to answer that, because I'm curious, this whole don't discriminate against Texans, don't mix with Texas, I guess, as a, you know, what did they say that provision means, and what do you guys believe it means?
Well, it was interesting to hear at oral argument the Solicitor General for Texas sort of back away from that reading of the don't discriminate against Texans provision, and it wasn't really entirely clear on what his answer was. He seemed to say, like, You could withdraw from Texas if you wanted to, but honestly, it was entirely clear.
He tried to hide behind personal jurisdiction, which was very unsatisfying. And as I recall, a justice did press him to say, no, under the law, and then he made a quick retreat.
Yeah, and I think there have been cases where, like, you know, Facebook has been sued in Texas, and Texas has said, like, we do have personal jurisdiction over you. So, I mean, that was a little bit inconsistent with that.
We're getting into the weeds here a little bit. To clarify, could the social media companies geofence Florida? Legally, yes. Technically, I'm a lawyer, not a, but there's a real question about whether it would be legal to do so with Texas because of this provision that says you can't discriminate.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no technical expert on this stage. I will say, easier said than done, especially with mobile phones. I will not dive into that further, not being the technical expert, but Texas's Solicitor General made it sound like you can just magically do that, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm. And let's open it up to the audience.
So assuming NetChoice does get a favorable outcome, do you think the analogy of them being a news publisher will be a significant factor? And if it is, I'm curious, what does that mean for their 230 protections down the line? Because one of the big arguments, as I understand it as a non-lawyer, for 230 is that they're not news publishers. They're a passive platform that's sharing content.
I think that's actually not right, as the lawyers argued. If they really were a passive platform, they wouldn't need 230, right? I mean, telephone companies don't need 230. They're not liable for what's transmitted. 230 exists precisely because they're not passive. And to the contrary, and again, this surprised me that Justice Alito wasn't getting this, the purpose of 230 is to encourage content moderation. That's the whole point of the second provision, is to say you can moderate and you're not going to be held liable as long as you act in good faith. So I think that argument is actually exactly wrong, honestly. I mean, I know it was being made a lot, but it strikes me as being the opposite of the way we should think about 230.
Yeah, I actually think it's worth diving into this a little bit further because it's actually pretty pernicious. Justice Gorsuch at one point said, well, doesn't Section 230 kind of make you a common carrier? And there's a lot of confusion over what the word publisher in 230 means. There's two distinct things. And once it's laid out, it's actually not that complicated. You have a First Amendment right to your editorial discretion, and you have a Section 230 protection from liability from most third-party speech that you host. That's it. It's not like, oh, well, Section 230 makes you not a publisher or, like, changes the ontology of what you are somehow. It's just an additional liability protection that is slapped onto your pre-existing First Amendment right. And if that gets mixed up, things could go pear-shaped very quickly. Let me illustrate. Section 230 protects users and providers of an interactive computer service. And Texas, in particular, gets hung up on the provider part and tries to sort of retcon Section 230 as this protection for big platforms. Section 230 protects your Twitter account or X account or whatever we're calling it. So if Section 230 makes an entity protected by it, a common carrier, your Twitter account is a common carrier, and the government can tell you what speech you have to repeat. So when the sort of bizarro world Section 230 points get raised at oral argument, you know, saying it doesn't make it so, I really hope they don't go down that route in this case where now, you know, we haven't briefed it and gotten into it. All this stuff got raised at the Gonzalez versus Google case, and it seemed like it made the justices back away. So it'd be pretty messed up for them to now turn around and do some crazy Section 230 opinion.
And let me add one more thing. I think your question actually illustrates a problem, which is that the problem of analogies. Lawyers like analogies. So we're like, social media platforms are like newspapers, only for some purposes. Nobody thinks Facebook is a newspaper, right? I mean, it's a very, very imperfect analogy. I just think, in the sense of editorial rights, it's the better analogy.
Jimmy? Not much to add. I guess I'll just say one thing about the intuition that if you are exercising First Amendment rights to publish something or your editorial discretion, then, like, you should face liability for it. Like, I think that's sort of the intuition motivating a lot of the justices. But, like, historically, that's just not true, right? Because you've always had, like, newsstands, for example, right? Like, you know, they carry magazines and newspapers, and they have a First Amendment right to decide, like, what to put in the first row or what to put in the bottom shelf. But, like, they've never been, you know, thought of as liable for, you know, any defamatory statement that might be in the newspaper, Right. So like that, I think that sort of intuition doesn't exactly hold. But
yeah. We have another online question here. Social media companies have determined they don't want their valuable trademarks associated with disinformation, racist comments, etc. Did any of the Amici briefs offer this justification for these private parties to curate the content that is publicly associated with their trademarks? So that's an interesting question, because I can see how that argument might be a little bit of a double-edged sword, because, of course, social media companies don't want to say they do endorse everything that is on their sites. So any thoughts on that?
Well, just to be clear, you don't need that to win, right? Because Jimmy brought up the PG&E case that was about PG&E, you know, the utility having to put speech that was not its own in its bills that it mailed out, and nobody was going to go, oh, this is PG&E's speech, or like it's associated. Ditto Miami Herald. I mean, nobody was going to be like, this politician ranting in the page is the Miami Herald. So I guess what I would say is it's probably true they don't want to be associated with it, and that does confirm, it confirms that it's expressive. What's going on? We're angry about all of the content moderation decisions one way or the other because they are expressive editorial choices. But it is not a necessary condition, no.
I would add, and because I don't have, you know, I have no relationship with the social media companies, it's part of their business model. And as if you look at what's happening with X, it's demonstrating this, right? They rely on advertising. What advertiser wants to have their ad pop up next to a neo-Nazi's post? Mm-hmm. And that's important because government laws that threaten the business model of medias, of any media, worry me a lot, right? I mean, that's the press clause really is about, preserving an independent media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just on the misattribution point, like, you know, Corbyn is right, like, in Tornillo, nobody would have confused the candidate's reply as the Miami Herald speech. Mm-hmm. And in all sorts of other compelled speech cases, going back to like Woolley versus, Maynard, yeah. Woolley versus Maynard, which is the case in New Hampshire about the license plate that says live free or die, right? Like, you know, like if I posted a bumper sticker that said, you know, peace is great, like that, I mean, nobody would have confused live free or die as my speech. But that's still, you're still being compelled to carry a message you don't want to carry. And in fact, like if you have to actually affirmatively disassociate yourself from that message, I mean, we think that just like doubles the compulsion rather than, it just doubles the First Amendment problem rather than sort of ameliorating it. And the court said that in a variety of different contexts.
Yeah, Justice Thomas is on record saying that justifies any compelled speech law then.
Yeah, yeah. And like on the point of misattribution, even if it does matter, I think like, you know, people do associate things that make it through on the websites with like the website's editorial judgment, which is why we have this law in the first place, right? It's like, you know, Florida and Texas are saying the reason why like we need to pass this law is because you're being, you know, you're discriminating against conservative content when you decide what to keep up and what to take down. And that just sort of gives the lie to all of their arguments about how, you know, like the speech won't be misattributed to the websites.
One more on that. There's a tie-in here to the Morthy case, which is being argued in a month, in which in that case, basically, conservative states are arguing that because the Biden administration was yelling at social media platforms to take down vaccine misinformation during the height of the COVID crisis, that meant that basically the platforms were being, the actions of the platforms could be attributable to the government and trigger the First Amendment. If platforms really were just like the telephone company, why was Joe Biden yelling at them? Mm-hmm. It's not like Biden was yelling at telephone companies, right? I mean, the facts of Morthy show that we absolutely hold platforms liable to some extent for failing to block harmful content. I mean, that's what that case is about.
That's a great point. Might have time for one quick, very quick question.
I don't know if it's quick, so I apologize. But the states seem to argue, or I seem to hear, that there is some sort of exception in their laws about moderating content that fit into the Section 230 C2A categories of obscene, lewd, lascivious. Did I hear that right? Is there any basis in the statutes for that type of exception for those types of categories? I didn't see one. So
this was another cul-de-sac during oral argument. Yeah, the Texas law definitely, I think the Florida law, although Jimmy can correct me, say, you know, you can do any content moderation that is consistent with federal law. And what I was kind of going bonkers about during the oral argument is you can't pass a blatantly unconstitutional, you know, First Amendment violating law and then stick in like a preemption provision and then be like, ha ha, our law is constitutional because it actually doesn't do anything because Section 230 blocks it. Because Congress can't narrow First Amendment rights, right? Like Congress can't pass a law that narrows the First Amendment. So sticking Section 230, you know, hypothetically, Congress could then like repeal Section 230 and your law would spring back to life. And it was a little annoying to be arguing over what is the preemptive scope of Section 230. And I should add, by the way, if Texas won this case, they would then turn around and argue for like the narrowest possible interpretation of Section 230. They'd probably even say it's unconstitutional. So I wish we hadn't even gone down that. I think it's totally irrelevant, but there's my take on it, Neil.
All right, well, we're going to have to sadly end it there, but let's all give a big hand to our fantastic panel.